I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and this was how I spent my Sunday. Reading people's handwriting. 3,200 pages of handwriting, to be exact. That's how many pages are equal to 1 year's worth of visitor logs to HHS, with White House officials and family members and a whole lot of HHS staff who forgot their badges having to sign in at the front desk. Those visitor logs were obtained through legal filings by a group called American Oversight, a new watchdog organization founded by Obama administration alumni, and they shared the logs with Politico first. And while I was combing through all the chicken scratch in those visitor logs, which did have some interesting nuggets about who was visiting and when, I was thinking more broadly about how we got here, the rise of these watchdog groups, with so many launching in the past year and a half. So on this episode of Pulse Check, we'll look closer at watchdog organizations, and you're going to hear from the leaders of two of them. One was started by a couple PhD students who saw federal web pages suddenly disappearing and changing, and the other is steered by a veteran of organizations like Planned Parenthood and NARAL, who says that reproductive health rights are under unprecedented attack. And despite their different approaches and different focuses, they do have a common thread that unites them. They want to bring new transparency to the federal government. We'll get to those conversations in a moment, but first a quick reminder. If you like Pulse Check, if you want to support us and help us, you can do your part too. Rate the show, review it, share it with a friend, and email me. I'm at ddiamond@politico.com about who you'd like to hear from and what topics we should be discussing. And now, here's my conversation with Mary Alice Carter, the leader of Equity Forward, a new group focused on reproductive health rights and access. Mary Alice joined me on Wednesday to discuss her organization's mission and why she's so worried about the Trump administration's policies and personnel. I hear from different advocacy groups every day. On the reproductive health front, there's Planned Parenthood, there's NARAL, there are LGBTQ advocacy groups like the Human Rights Campaign, the NAACP, the Conference on Civil Rights, the list goes on. Why does the world need Equity Forward too?
Equity Forward was founded because we are an organization that does something solely that no other organization in this progressive space does. And that's that we do comprehensive research into foes of reproductive health care to bring out into the light the who, what is happening behind the scenes to affect reproductive health care. We don't do what anyone else does. We don't do policy. We don't elect people to office. We don't do patient care. We don't take anyone to court over policies. We are simply focused on the research, getting that information, and bringing it out into light, both for our own use in order to bring to people and to share with other organizations so they can have the information to do that kind of work.
Would your organization have been created if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, a very different president in terms of reproductive health rights?
There's not a lot of things I know for certain, Dan, but here's one thing I know for certain. If the woman who once said women's rights are human rights and human rights are women's rights were sitting in that White House, I don't think there'd be an awful lot of watchdoggering we would have had to do around reproductive health care in the administration. And what I will also say is this is the first administration in the 50 years of Title X that has gone after the fundamental background and reason that Title X exists. So are you asking me would I have done it under another administration? There's never been an administration like this one that is both very secretive in how they make their decisions and is doing the kind of moves to undermine reproductive health like this administration.
You're a former Planned Parenthood executive. When Equity Forward launched in January, this is how a website called LifeSite News covered the announcement, quote, ex-Planned Parenthood VP launches new initiative to smear pro-life pregnancy centers. Is your organization giving conservatives exactly what they warn about and fear, that Planned Parenthood and reproductive health groups are spreading their tentacles into the political space and pushing for an agenda?
It is true that I work for Planned Parenthood, and I'm very proud to have spent time working for really a gold standard, high-quality healthcare provider in this country. And when I came on to Equity Forward, I came on to do the work because I have decades of experience working in reproductive health care and making sure that people get access to equitable care wherever they are, no matter where they live. So I'm not sure I could speak for what their fear is for the work that we're doing, but I do know that we do have to be involved in political work, and that can often be with a small p political. It doesn't mean we need to be involved in electoral work, but we do need to be involved in the decisions that are being made that affect the health care of millions and millions of Americans. And what I will also say about being brought up in an anti-choice publication, which means that they're taking note of the fact that we have our eyes on them and they aren't going to be able to continue doing the kind of things that they do without being accountable for those actions.
So give the listeners an example. I've worked with your group before on a few different projects. What's one thing that Equity Forward is doing that no other group has done?
Well, I'd say there are other groups that are doing, say, FOIA research, who are doing using the Freedom of Information Act in order to get materials, documents, files from the federal government. There are other groups doing that type of work, but we are exclusively looking at reproductive health care when we do that work. We are solely focused on what is happening in that arena to make sure that we're ensuring equitable access for people who need reproductive health care.
So one example might be you've drilled down into the leadership of the Office of Population Affairs, where Title X funding is being adjudicated, or Scott Lloyd, the controversial head of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Equity Forward has been very proactive at looking at their statements, their backgrounds, disseminating that to other advocacy groups and reporters.
Sure. And so those are two great examples of offices and people who have great effect on reproductive health care. Not that you would have thought the Office of Refugee Resettlement would become ground zero for an abortion fight, but with this administration, anything's possible. So we've looked at, so those are two examples. We're probably tracking about 13 individuals right now, and that grows on a weekly basis for how many we really want to take a look at, because new characters pop up every day.
Do those individuals know that you're tracking them? I mean, are you investigating them to the level that they are aware of it?
So I probably don't want to use investigation and tracking, because that sounds a little more nefarious than what we're up to. But we definitely put those profiles on our website. So if you go to our website, which is equityfwd.org, we have those profiles up of some people that we're taking a look at. So they would know in that sense. And we do put out their profiles and that information into the press so it can be available.
We've mentioned a few of those. Scott Lloyd, Teresa Manning had been the head of Office of Population Affairs. She's been replaced by Valerie Huber, an abstinence advocate. Who are some of the other folks that you are tracking?
Well, definitely. I mean, Valerie Huber is incredibly important to us because of the role that she has overseeing Title X. And for those that don't know, Title X is our nation's family planning program. It's been around for almost 50 years, gives grants so low-income individuals can access reproductive health care. Valerie Huber has taken over that program right now, and she's a former abstinence advocate. And so she is not someone who is completely pro contraception and a lot of the things that program's done before. So we're really keeping an eye on her. Also in her office, there's a gentleman named Steve Valentine. He was responsible for the teen pregnancy prevention program being obliterated by this administration. And I think if there's one thing we can all agree on, it's that finding solutions to reduce teen unintended pregnancy is a good idea.
And listeners to this podcast might remember that a few weeks ago we talked to Kathy Hayes, the Seattle public health director who is suing HHS over its decision to get rid of the teen pregnancy prevention program. And she went into detail on why that program mattered so much to public health. So the Trump administration has made several big personnel shifts in HHS. One of those was Tom Price has departed and Alex Azar took over as HHS secretary this year. In your view, how is Azar doing on the issues that you think matter most?
I think a lot of us hoped, I won't even say I think, a lot of us did hope that Alex Azar coming in would lend a grown-up in the room to HHS. And a lot of people were saying he's coming in, he's not a long-term ideologue, he worked at HHS before. We've looked at his background. He is not a long-term ideologue when it comes to this issue. He doesn't come from working at the helm of an anti-abortion or an anti-choice organization. However, what we've noticed in the few months that Alex Azar has been in office, not only has he done nothing to remove the very people that are undermining these programs, just in the last 2 days, he's come out in support of the people who are doing these programs. For example, just yesterday, yet another federal court said that the Office of Refugee Resettlement and its director, Scott Lloyd, could not stop immigrants in this country from accessing abortion care, which they've been doing repeatedly. Federal courts have now said several times, you can't do this. And HHS, under Alex Azar's leadership came out and said, we still disagree with this policy, and we still think we're doing the right thing by blocking care. So any decision coming out of HHS now is Alex Azar's baggage.
So you've really targeted Scott Lloyd and had said to Alex Azar when he was testifying on the Hill that if he didn't fire Lloyd, then Lloyd's problems would be on him. How much does it matter, though, if Scott Lloyd went away? Wouldn't there be someone else waiting in the wings? We saw this with Title X. Teresa Manning was a critic of contraception. She left. Now Valerie Huber slid into that spot.
Yeah, that's why we're saying the issues now, the buck stops with Alex Azar. And as much as it's important that Scott Lloyd pushed this policy forward, we also know from our research he's not the only one. He wasn't the only one responsible for that program. We know that there's multiple people at multiple rungs at HHS who think like he does. So you're absolutely right that more and more can come in and fill those spots. We're not under the impression that getting rid of one person will change the policy. But what we are aware is that knowing who those people are and actually knowing who's in the wings is really important to know what next move they may make.
Has the Trump administration done anything positive, in your view, for vulnerable populations?
When it comes to the issue of reproductive health, I can't think of anything positive that this administration has done. As a matter of fact, I can think of a ton of negatives. One incredible place I would talk about is the Office of Civil Rights, which is an office that existed before but has been reimagined under this administration to really allow people to use their religious beliefs to deny care to people based on who they are. And a lot of that's showing up when we talk about LGBTQ populations. So it could be allowing someone to deny care to someone who wanted to do gender reassignment surgery, or even just is a gender nonconforming person who wants health care, and someone could say, you're against my beliefs, I'm not going to give you that care. So we're seeing really radical shifts in how we perceive where people deserve care.
You've been doing this for 2 decades?
Yes.
not to date you, but just to get to your depth of experience. What is the trend line that you have seen across your career?
There have been some incredible advancements in reproductive health care in the past 2 decades. We have been incredibly fortunate to have a lot of development when it comes to birth control. So now we have methods that are long-term, they're more effective, things like the IUD, things like the implant, the long-term shot, things that really allow people to use a birth control method that is highly reliable and allow them to plan and space their pregnancy with a lot of power. So that's been incredibly positive. What has been negative is watching how polarized this issue has become at a political level, because I will say in the public, birth control is not controversial. 99% of sexually active heterosexual women will use birth control at some point in their lifetimes. And I may add, that's of a huge benefit to heterosexual men, right? We like to talk about this issue a lot of times when it's a women's issue, but let's be frank, there are a lot of heterosexual men who are benefiting from birth control. So what we've seen, though, is it become very polarized among a very small group of people, largely in Washington, who want to fight over this. But out in the world, it's not controversial. Out in the world, it's not a partisan issue. If you go to a healthcare provider, people are walking through the door who voted for Trump, who voted for Clinton, who maybe didn't vote at all. They're there because they need healthcare. And we know that they're not following the politics of it. They're just saying, hey, guess what? I'm not ready to have a child yet, and I want to make sure I'm using the best option for me in order to do that. So the ways it's become better, I think we've also dropped a lot of the stigmatism around birth control, not so much around abortion, and we still need to work on that, but it's definitely become more polarized.
Are you an advocate? Are you an activist? Is there a difference between the two?
I think for most people, they don't think that there's a difference between those two words. A lot of times when I think about advocacy, I do think about doing that work on behalf of a population that I may not be part of myself, but am using the power that I have to influence change. So I myself am a white woman, and I know that the vast majority of people that are affected by these policies are black and brown women, gender nonconforming people, LGBTQ folks, although I myself am a lesbian, I also find myself working on behalf of other folks that maybe don't have the same gender privilege that I do. So when I think about myself as an advocate, I think about myself using the power that I have to speak and to make sure that I center the thoughts and the needs of people that are in vulnerable populations that may not have the platform that I do. And that's what Equity Forward really wants to do.
Last question. If I was sitting down with you on December 31st, 2018, what would Equity Forward have had to accomplish this year for it to have been a success in your eyes?
It's a great question. So we're watching people sit in Times Square and we're thinking, I wouldn't do that because it's probably cold. So it's December 31st. And we're thinking to ourselves, is this a good year? Okay, so it's a good year for Equity Forward if we've done a few things. If we've really held people accountable for the policies that they're doing. So we're under no illusion that by doing the work that Equity Forward's doing, that Donald Trump is suddenly going to wake up tomorrow and say, forget it. I support birth control. I'm not going to think that Alex Azar tomorrow is going to go in and clean house. We're not delusional in that sense. But what we are saying is we will be successful if we have made sure that people are aware of who's behind the scenes, that we've slowed down some of those processes, that we've held them accountable for it. And yes, I think in some cases we will be able to get a few people removed from office because they will become so difficult. And us raising the level of what they're doing to a public awareness level will make it more difficult. Example with Scott Lloyd. There's got to be a point when this government says, the actions of this person is costing us so much money in going to court that we can no longer have this person be tenable. And you would think in any other job that would probably be the case. So that would be success for us if we could slow it down, if we could mitigate some of the policies, and if we could make sure that people are aware and becoming active around agencies the same way they're talking about becoming active around elections.
Mary Alice Carter, head of Equity Forward, thank you for joining me in Washington, D.C.
Thank you for having me.
And with that, let's get to Tolly Rinberg and Rachel Bergman of the Web Integrity Project at the Sumlia Foundation. I first talked to this group last summer when they were issuing their early reports, and they've since joined up with the Sumlia Foundation, a well-regarded transparency organization. Tolly and Rachel sat down with me in the Politico office this week, right by her main newsroom, in case you occasionally hear folks walking by. Tolly, you're a physicist in the middle of getting your Harvard PhD. Why are a couple of grad students doing this work?
So the work really began after the presidential election. My friend and colleague, Andrew Bergman, and I, like you say, were pursuing our PhD in applied physics, and we were thinking about how to respond to what we thought broadly was the incoming administration, undermining democratic institutions broadly, but specifically we were thinking about what we could do. And we got involved with an organization called the Environmental Data and Governance Initiative that responded to what a lot of scientists, librarians thought were a concern to removals of data. But thankfully that actually hasn't happened. What we have seen, though, has been a removal and reduction access to websites, web pages, documents. As a result of that, we launched this effort to systematically monitor federal websites and have now expanded that work to the Web Integrity Project at the Sunlight Foundation.
So let's talk about what you're finding. And I've worked with your group on some specific reports related to healthcare, but maybe broad level across the Trump administration. How are federal websites changing? How has web transparency changed?
Right. So what we found, it's really, I would say, sort of a digital Wild West. A lot of agencies, a lot of offices approach this very differently. First thing to say is that it's totally normal for websites to change. I don't think that should surprise everyone. But when resources and content is removed has public value and is not justified, the public deserves to know about that. And moreover, the public doesn't really have, beyond sort of journalistic efforts and work by civil society, it doesn't have a way to find out about this. And so that's what, spotlighting these issues is what we aim to do. As an example, famously, last year in April, the EPA's climate change website was removed for reasons. The reasons that were given were because they were being updated to align with the priorities of Administrator Pruitt and President Trump. End of this month, it'll be a year since that website has been removed. And the only content that was put back were resources for tribal, local, and state governments. But it was put back without climate change information. So you can ask, what is a climate change website without climate change information? It's actually one that only focuses on energy resources. You know, among those removals was also a website, a student's guide to global climate change. Middle schoolers were using that. I was at a dinner with my friend's house, and their daughter was using that website. But now the class has to use an archived version of that website. So you can ask, what does it mean that a class uses an archived version of a climate change website? It's no longer the position of the EPA that should be a public website. At the Treasury Department, we've seen tax analysis reports removed. These are just research reports, and they were removed without explanation. We're seeing this quiet removal all throughout.
Let's bring it back to HHS. And Rachel, your sphere of work at Sunlight Foundation is targeted on the health space. How many significant changes has your organization seen so far under the Trump administration to healthcare content?
Yeah, so right now we're looking at over 20,000 web pages weekly spanning across various HH offices, including the Office of Population Affairs, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And we are continuously documenting important changes. And you know, there's a threshold of, you know, we see changes that we feel are important and change a user's experience on a particular web page, but we're not reporting on all of them. So far we've put out 4 reports on trends and topics that we think are important for the public to be aware of. So one of the particular trends that we've noticed so far emerging within our reports and upcoming reports is a trend in reduced access to information related to vulnerable populations, including the LGBT community, racial minorities, immigrants. So our very first report was about how reports on sexual orientation and gender identity data collection have been made inaccessible on a federal statistical methodology website. And these are reports that people were using. So we actually became aware of the fact that they were inaccessible because a colleague of ours approached us and said, hey, I've been trying to find these reports and I'm getting a PDF that says they're under construction. And over the last year, we've actually, you know, there's been reporting on the fact that agencies are trying to change federal surveys, removing questions related to sexual orientation and gender identity. So these reports were very relevant to ongoing political discussions and discussions within the LGBT community. We've seen this trend extend. So the report that you worked with us was about the removal of a resource related to lesbian bisexual health at the Office on Women's Health website. And so this was a resource that talked about, you know, what does it mean to be a lesbian bisexual woman? What are the specific health needs of lesbian bisexual women? What are risks that they have related to health, and how can they improve their health? And, you know, now we've seen that all the content that was on that webpage is not on the rest of the Office on Women's Health website. And so these are two examples of kind of what we're seeing as an emerging trend of removals of information related to the LGBT community, for instance. We're also now starting to see trends and beginning to report on trends about removals related to information resources on the Affordable Care Act. So both shifts in language and messaging, but maybe more significantly, changes in information about the Affordable Care Act. Links being removed to access web pages, entire resources related to the Affordable Care Act. So we're by no means the first group to sort of discuss those types of removals. There's been reporting in the last year. There was a New York Times piece about how information has been removed related to, you know, doctor choice, how you can, you know, go out of network if you have coverage under the Affordable Care Act and what you can access in that way, and emergency services. And in our most recent report, we also noted that and the removal of a breast cancer website at the Office on Women's Health, there was information about how women can access free screenings if they're over 40 under the Affordable Care Act.
So as you mentioned, I've done some reporting here. I understand that there's a climate within HHS around pulling back LGBTQ resources. I've done several stories there. HHS has said these resources have been taken off websites because they were either optimizing the website or no one was visiting these pages and the content has been integrated elsewhere. Do you agree with that explanation?
Yeah. So to your second point that they weren't being used, we haven't seen any evidence that, you know, specifically the resource on lesbian bisexual health was not being used. We haven't seen numbers. I think in your own reporting, you noted that the Office on Women's Health gets about 700,000 visits.
This is womenshealth.gov, 700,000 visits a month, which makes it one of the most popular federal websites.
Yeah, absolutely. So if it's being visited that many times, it's possible that people were using the lesbian bisexual resource. It being integrated into the rest of the website, we haven't seen the extent of the content that was on that resource found elsewhere on womenshealth.gov. This resource in particular was made for a reason. Whether there's content scattered elsewhere on the website, someone made the decision to create a resource that aggregated all this information about lesbian bisexual women in particular. HHS has commented on why they removed it. It wasn't mobile friendly, perhaps. It was, the information is found elsewhere. But we don't find their reasoning to fully explain why this particular resource is not up on their website at this time. Whether or not it was the intent of the office to do so, by removing this resource, it's created confusion about whether the removal has anything to do with underlying policy of the office and policy related to LGBT health. In response to the reporting from you and others about the removal of this resource, there's an outcry from the LGBTQ community and advocates who, want to see this up online.
Well, I am curious about the impact here, because my understanding is your group has issued reports and the administration consistently has said there was a good reason for removing these web pages. The web pages haven't come back. And on the flip side, political opponents of the administration have seized on the findings. Your breast cancer report this week that the Office of Women's Health had taken down breast cancer resources. The Democratic National Committee just came out with a statement saying, quote, the Department of Health and Human Services removal of information about life-saving preventive breast cancer treatment, is yet another example of disregard for women and their health and well-being by the Trump administration. Are you worried that a few web page removals could be taken out of context to fuel some larger political narrative?
I'm certainly worried about that, and our process, I think, reflects our concern there. We work really hard to look systematically across, as Rachel said, 20,000 web pages pertaining to health and healthcare, but also beyond. We have to make some decisions about what we prioritize in monitoring. But at the end of the day, this isn't just about the removal of one web page. What we're talking about here is we're working to create really a foundation from which we can actually start and have a debate about policy. We're creating these technical reports. If anyone has an issue with these reports, please let us know. But as far as we know, they're technically accurate, and we've documented this change. From there, anyone can have a conversation, and journalists have participated in this conversation. Now the DNC has, but also the civil society as well.
In your view, where does pulling down websites rank as a problem at a time when the administration is quietly changing regulations or installing controversial personnel?
I would say by itself, it certainly scales with the significance of the website, healthcare.gov. If that suddenly was taken down, that would be extremely problematic. A PDF that was removed may not be as much. The significance here is really leads that into understanding how offices and webs and agencies make decisions about how they present information and policies, right? It might not be so significant that a sentence is removed, but it is significant that there's an internal memo that says we will now no longer refer to, this particular term in this way. As we have seen with climate change, and we're working to understand if similar things are happening with the Affordable Care Act or other policies.
And I'd say it also helps create a fuller narrative of the regulations. That might be a bigger issue. You've done a lot of reporting on sort of a de-emphasis of LGBTQ health at HHS. And, you know, a single PDF, single web page about lesbian bisexual health might not be as big as some of the other policies and regulations that we've seen, but it sort of fits into a narrative and sort of helps show a trend that's building that we're seeing across the agency and other agencies.
Tolly Renberg, Rachel Bergman from the Sunlight Foundation's Web Integrity Project, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Tolly Renberg and Rachel Bergman of the Sunlight Foundation's Web Integrity Project and Mary Alice Carter, head of Equity Forward. And thanks to Micaela Rodriguez for producing the show. You can rate Pulse Check, you can review, you can share it with a friend. All of those things help us keep producing the show. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your favorite podcast player next week.